We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus. Good morning. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking about air travel. And certainly this is something that we've talked about on the show before, mostly with people who were analysts of the air industry and approached it from a business point of view, although we certainly talked about issues like safety and security, for example. This morning, we'll try to approach some of the same issues from a perspective that is a little bit different. We'll be talking this morning with someone who flies for a living, airline pilot and freelance writer Patrick Smith. He's air travel columnist for Solan.com and is host of the website AskThePilot.com. He's also author of a book that deals with basic questions and answers about flying. That book is titled Ask the Pilot, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel, and it's available as a paperback. It's published by Penguin. Now, we'll try to talk about a number of things this morning. As I said in promoting the show, we can't help you with lost luggage. Please don't call if you have questions about frequent flyer miles. The idea here is it's an opportunity to ask questions about flying and get a pilot's perspective. So basic kinds of questions, and they're the kinds of things that he deals in the book, deals with in the book in the column. You have basic questions about flying. You can ask those. And we will be talking a little bit about some of the challenges of today of being both a passenger and a pilot. So questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's the local number. So if you're in Champaign-Urbana, that's the number to use. Toll free. 800-222-9455. So if it's a long-distance call, use that number. Calls on us. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that too. That's will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions are welcome. We hope people would try to be brief just so we can get in as many callers as possible. But certainly, questions are welcome. And Patrick Smith, hello.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for talking with us. So are you one of those people who, when you were a kid, said you wanted to be a pilot and actually managed to grow up and be one?
Yeah, I guess I am. You know, it goes back really before I can even remember. When I was a little kid, I used to make pilgrimages out to the airport on weekends. And, you know, it wasn't the thrill of flight per se that intrigued me as much as kind of the whole theater of air travel. You know, where these big jets were flying off to, which countries, you know, the whole idea of planes connecting countries and continents and cultures, you know, that's what got me excited.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's funny because it reminds me of when I was a kid. I'm a little older than you are, but when I was a kid, I was taken out to O'Hare Airport, which in those days was a much smaller place, just to watch planes take off and land. And the idea that somebody would do that now, given the way we think about air travel, that we sort of the equivalent of going down to the train station and watching trains come and go. And yet at a point, it was a novel and almost romantic kind of idea. And maybe that was because it was something that not everyone could do.
Well, that's exactly why. You know, air travel is now affordable and accessible to pretty much everybody, and that's taken a lot of the sheen off of it. You know, it still can be, for lack of a better term, glamorous and exciting. You know, flying internationally, long-haul flights to exotic places around the world. I mean, let's face it, going from Baltimore to St. Louis just, you know, isn't the most fascinating trip in the world. It's not a whole lot different from driving or getting on a bus anymore, but you know, the excitement still is out there if you look for it and know where to find it.
Yeah. Well, I think that you make an important point, and it's something I think people have to keep in mind when we all complain about flying not being all that pleasant. It's the fact that it has now become accessible to an awful lot of people. It is a quick way to get from point A and B, to be generally speaking, if things are going well that day, and in an affordable way. So it's not the most luxurious thing, and sometimes it is perilously like the bus. But, you know, it is open to an awful lot of people that 50 years ago or 40 years ago or 45 years ago just wouldn't be able to do it. The option of hopping on a plane and going from New York to San Francisco or New York to London, for that matter, it was just not open to to everybody.
Yeah, I think the indignities, the hassles of air travel are duly noted. They don't really need any introduction. But as you point out, flying is affordable and accessible. Airfares right now are about what they were in the early 1980s. You know, almost everybody can afford to fly, and not only is it cheap, but you've got planes going pretty much everywhere all the time. The system is, for the most part, reliable. Most flights get to where they're going on time, about 85% of them. And on top of that, what people often don't acknowledge is how astonishingly safe it is to fly. Mm-hmm. So you're getting there at a good price in reasonable comfort, reasonable efficiency, in almost perfect safety. You know, that's a lot to ask for, and we're getting it.
And that's another every time there is a story about a problem, and there are problems, you know, a plane suddenly develops a hole in the body, or an air traffic controller is found to be asleep, or, you know, there's something happens, that's going to get a lot of attention and should have attention if it points to problems. But I'm sure that at the same time, people who are involved in the industry would like to remind flyers or potential flyers that it's about the safest form of travel that we have.
Not only that, but statistically, it's about six times safer than it was a quarter century ago, even with double the number of planes flying than were flying in 1980. I mean, that's just remarkable, and it really goes unmentioned. And one of the reasons is, you know, the media has a tendency to hype and really spin up what are comparatively minor incidents. So we've seen a whole slew of them recently. You know, from the Southwest incident, which was potentially serious, to, you know, a landing gear problem at JFK, a landing gear problem over here. I mean, just, you know, very minor things that get their 15 minutes in the spotlight and help to perpetuate this notion that flying is more dangerous than ever before, when really it's safer than it's ever been.
Well, for you as a pilot, as someone who flies for a living, I'm going back to this the riding the bus image, where particularly for relatively short domestic flights, it pretty much is now, aside from, you know, the security issues and what you have to do to check in and so forth, it's pretty much like riding the bus. So for you as a pilot, is it kind of like driving a bus?
No, not really. If only because, you know, it's something that I had in my heart and something that I've wanted to do my whole life. So it never really becomes humdrum. I mean, you know, flying can occasionally be boring for the pilots just as it is for the passengers. But I'm never going to say that I don't enjoy it.
Mm. One other thing.
You'll find most airline pilots will say the same thing. I think you have to have that in you to kind of go through what you need to go through to make it into the profession and to stay in the profession, which, you know, has been pointed out lately is, you know, not what it used to be in terms of pay and benefits and working conditions and everything else. It's not an easy job.
One other thing, and I'm starting to get some callers here, so we get some callers in. People, I think, frequently have heard stories or read stories about today's airplanes, today's commercial planes, and the level of technology in the plane, and they have heard or read the phrase, the plane can fly itself. And just recently, I think this was in connection with the issue of the air traffic controller being asleep, I heard some analyst talking about this and the general issue of air safety, and he even said something in this interview to the effect of, well, the plane can actually land itself if it had to. I'm sure that as a pilot, you hear those sorts of things and you probably get kind of irritated. What really is the job of the pilot? And when you have an aircraft that's highly automated, what does that mean for you?
I mean, this is a big topic, and it is one of those things that drives me crazy, because you hear all the time. You know, people talking about how planes, quote-unquote, fly themselves, and then the pilot is just kind of sitting there as a backup, and eventually pilots are going to be engineered out of the picture altogether. All of that is nonsense. The analogy I like to make is that cockpit automation helps a pilot the way automation in an operating room helps a surgeon. a plane can no more fly itself than an operating room can perform an operation by itself. There's such a thing as an auto land. Most modern planes are equipped with this feature. Actually, it's been around since the late 60s, I think. And people hear that and they envision the pilot, you know, pressing a button and just sitting there in the plane, just zoop, you know, floats down and lands. Where really the fine print of how to set up one of these procedures and oversee it and make sure everything is working right is something I could talk about all day. The vast, vast majority of landings are the old-fashioned manual kind because, frankly, an automatic landing is a lot more work-intensive than a manual one. So they're not really performed all that often.
Well, we have a couple of callers here. Let me go to the phones, and again, I'll introduce the guest for this hour. We're talking with Patrick Smith. He's an airline pilot. He is air travel columnist for Salon.com and host of the website AskThePilot.com. And if you have questions, you can give us a call. He'll do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. First caller is in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. I had a question about a little detail here. Seatbelts in the planes and the seatbelt sign. Passengers, I imagine, are required to wear a seatbelt on takeoff and landing. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Now, during the flight itself, when you get into maybe some turbulence and it goes on, does that sign also have the same force? I mean, are passengers obligated to put it on mid-flight?
Yeah, if the sign comes on and if you're instructed to put your seatbelt on, really you have to. You know, there's a regulation that says pretty much you have to obey all the commands of a flight crew, and that's one of them.
Uh-huh.
During smooth portions of flight, no, you don't have to have your seatbelt on, but it's always a good idea to leave it on. The crew does for the entire flight, and you should too, just in case. It's a pretty minor inconvenience.
Right. No, I can understand the safety aspect, but I've been on some flights where it seems that the seatbelt sign has been on all the time, which just seems to take away its force as to when it should be on. So it should not be left on if there's no reason for it to be on. Is that correct?
Yeah, I you know, honestly, sometimes we forget to turn it off when the air is smooth.
Okay.
And you're right. Being too conservative with the sign, I think, encourages people to ignore it. A lot of it is subjective. I mean, it's crew's decision, captain's decision, whether or not to turn it on sometime.
Right. And if you needed to visit the facilities while it was on mid-flight, you're still obligated to sit there?
Well, technically, yeah. I mean, the best thing to do in that case is call a cabin crew member over and see what they say about what you should do. And they can make arrangements.
Okay, great. Don't forget to shut it off when they don't need it, though. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. Let's go on to someone in Vermilion County calling on a cell phone, line two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, I'm calling just to protest about your saying it's humdrum. I, too, grew up near O'Hare and would spend hours out there watching go. But, you know, nowadays, even when I'm intending to fly, I'd like to linger out there because especially at night when you get a good vantage point, you can look back at the approach and you can see maybe 10 airplanes strung out with their lights on. They look like pearls on an invisible necklace just coming in, and it's always impressed me that some person in there can manage to wrestle that machine out of the sky and land so smoothly. It just takes my breath away, and I love sitting there still watching those machines take off and land. And when I'm going off on a flight, sometimes I do treat it like a bus ride. If I'm tired and it's going to be nighttime, I'll just go to sleep and sit there for the 2-3 hours that it takes. But when some of those planes have a nice little screen that can track you. You know, it'll show you a map, and it shows the airplane in position. And I really like to watch that, but I'd really wonder why sometime we don't get a screen that shows what the pilot sees out the front. Would that ever be possible?
You know, back in the day, American Airlines used to have a video link up with the cockpit where you could actually watch the pilots at work during takeoffs and landings. That went away in the late 1970s, I think it was. You know, you're one of a dwindling few of us who can still savor these things, I guess. You know, I fly internationally a lot, and it's a little bit different in countries where air travel is not taken for granted. You still see at some airports, for example, people coming out to the fences just to watch the planes go by, observation decks at the airports full of people. It's kind of neat to see that. And
I think it's...
You know, I'm old enough to remember when people would routinely burst into applause every time a plane landed. The people in the cabin would just start clapping on landing. You hardly ever experience that anymore. But
well, we do that once in a while when it's rough weather and the guy actually sticks it and does a nice job. You know, we've had some pretty rough landings going into Oklahoma City when the wind just shifts so much and you're thinking, oh, my God, he's going to fly around. But he doesn't, and he lands with a thump, and it's really a good feeling to be on the ground. I'm not interested in watching the pilot working. I'm interested in, you know, the gazing out the window and having, you know, a view of the mountains or whatever we're going over. You know,
well, a lot of airlines now, mostly European, Asian carriers, do have video links where you can watch different viewpoints, vantage points through your seat back TV. Some of the new Boeings and Airbuses, some of them actually have a view that looks off the back of the tail.
Ooh.
Kind of neat to watch during climb because it's on takeoff and you can watch the ground sort of fall away. There's another shot that points straight down where you can just kind of bird's eye view of what you're flying over. Again, mostly it's carriers outside the U.S. that have these options installed.
I don't go.
They are out there.
In the States, so I guess I'm stuck. Okay.
All right.
I'm just the one peering out the window and marveling at how the wing works and everything. So I really like that stuff.
All right. Well,
thanks
for the call. I appreciate it. Well, I do. I guess I must confess I don't fly a lot, but when I am at the airport, I do. And you sit there and you look out and you see that there are planes sitting there. Maybe you do see a plane taking off. And I guess I do still find myself being a little amazed at the idea that this thing, this enormous thing, can actually fly. There's something about it that's still, and I guess I generally understand the principle, you know, but the idea that this enormous, heavy thing can actually get off the ground and fly, when I think about it, it's still kind of amazing.
I'm going to let you keep being as romantic as you'd like about that. Dissect that and make it seem kind of, you know, if I explain it all away, it's going to make what I do for a living seem less exciting. So,
well, I guess I basically sort of understand the principle of the wing and the fact that once the top surface is curved and the bottom surface is more flat and the air goes faster over the one side than the other and that creates lift and all that. I got that. But still, that seems to sort of amaze me that such a thing is possible.
Well, it should. You know, a 747 weighs almost 1 million pounds. You've got the new Airbus A380 for all its ugliness aesthetically. It's a pretty impressive machine. It can take off at over 1 million pounds. But pretty much anything can be made to fly if you give it enough thrust and enough lift.
Our guest in this hour is Patrick Smith. He's an airline pilot. He's an air travel columnist for Salon.com, host of AskThePilot.com, and we are talking about air travel and getting the perspective of somebody who flies professionally. And if you have questions about being a passenger or being a pilot, you can call us 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just also to pick up on something that you talked about, that I think that if you fly, when you get on the plane, you walk through first class. And maybe people have had the experience of being bumped and actually knowing what it's like to fly first class. And one of the things that you've written about it actually, though, is, and maybe this is true of international flying and of airlines of other countries, that there are places where flying coach is not so bad.
That's very true. Again, it, you know, that experience tends to be outside the U.S. Most of the Asian carriers, European carriers, even some of the bigger South American carriers, you know, they tend to offer a better economy class product than what the U.S. carriers offer. you know, how that came to be, you know, maybe is something we could talk about all day. Is the declined state of airline service in the U.S., you know, a symptom of just, you know, the fall of our service culture? Is it all in the interest of making a profit? I don't know. It's probably a little bit cultural, a little bit economic. It's all different things. But, you know, at the end of the day, sadly, our airlines don't really compare to those overseas.
Well, let's pick up on that question. And when you talk about if it's become unpleasant and they have cut down on the amenities and now you have to pay for everything and they're squeezed as many seats into the plane as they possibly can, that some people will say, well, what that is about is profits for the airline. And I'm sure that people at the airline turn right around and say, well, you know, do you want a cheap flight or not? I mean, what you passenger are saying to us is that you want the least expensive way to go. It's expensive to maintain the planes. The fuel is expensive. We got to pay our wages of our crews. And so we're looking for ways to trim costs. So I'm sure the airline says to passengers, well, okay, what do you want? Do you want economy? Or do you want luxury? Which of those two things is it really?
Well, time and time again, when airlines survey people, far and away, what people want more than anything is a cheap ticket. And they're getting their cheap tickets, but they can't expect to be pampered at the same time.
Well, one of the things I want to talk about is this issue that has been in the news lately about air traffic controllers falling asleep. And there has been a couple of highly publicized incidents lately, which also maybe points to a system. And maybe it even comes to the planes, a system that is fatigued. And we have air traffic controllers apparently who are working rolling shifts and working all hours of the day or night, and they're just understandably tired. What's going on, do you think, with the air traffic control system and particularly the human piece of it?
Well, you know, I don't know a whole lot about the air traffic control system, the inner workings of it. I do have a friend who is a tower controller, and he says the system is stressed to some extent. But I don't really see a crisis out there. I think these recent stories have been partly overblown. What happened is inexcusable, but at the same time, the context is a lot bigger than what people are told by the media. I wouldn't read too much into it, but sure, there are improvements that need to be made in the ATC system, which is not only stressed from a human factors point of view, but it probably needs some technological upgrading as well.
Well, that's also something I want to ask you about, because it is something now, I think, at least for a couple of years, people have been talking about the need to develop the next air traffic control system, or the air traffic control system of the future, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, and that they have said that because of now our ability to track planes, to monitor their position, that we really need to take advantage of that technology to an extent we're not doing it now. And that, for example, people say, well, because we have satellites and all sorts of things, we can track planes very, very accurately. For that reason, they would say something like, and we can close up the spacing between planes. We don't have to keep them as far apart as we do now. And that would actually, the benefit there would be getting more on-time arrivals and departures, and the whole system could move a lot more smoothly. And I wonder, what do you think about that as a pilot?
Well, that's what you just said is mostly true. I think our ATC system is inefficient, outmoded. It wastes time. It wastes fuel. Separation is something that could be looked at. We could put certain reductions in place there based on the technology that we have. Why isn't this happening? Well, anytime you've got the FAA involved, things just move slowly. And also we've had funding cut. there's just not a lot of emphasis to get this done, which is too bad, because I think you're going to see a lot of other countries moving forward with these things while we kind of lag behind. But having said that, you know, the system is not by any means antiquated. It works pretty well. And no matter what we do, it's not going to solve the issue of congestion. We sometimes hear, well, if only the air traffic system was upgraded, you know, all these delays would go away. That's simply not true. The reason we have delays is because it's not an airspace issue as much as an airports issue. You've just got too many takeoffs and landings going into certain airports. And until airlines better rationalize their schedules and their timetables, that's not really going to go away.
For you as a pilot, did the opportunity when you talk to a controller know that you're talking to a person, do you like that? Is it somehow more assuring having human contact? Would it be different or more disconcerting or something if you were really dealing with a computer at that point?
Well, I think ideally it would be a mix of those things. Sure, there's a certain psychological comfort that comes, you know, talking directly to a person, taking instructions directly from the voice. But, you know, flying internationally over the oceans, you actually do a lot of communicating by data link, which is to say a keyboard, with ATC facilities that are sometimes thousands of miles away.
Mm. So there's never, so on a flight like that, on an international flight where you are either flying across the Pacific or the Atlantic, are there times when you're actually out of contact with anybody, or is there always some contact, but it would be by that method, and you certainly wouldn't be talking to anybody?
There's always some contact. Exactly how that contact is made varies facility to facility, even plane to plane, depending which equipment is installed. You've got VHF, HF, data link, STATCOM, different ways of reaching people, whether that person is an air traffic controller or company staff. You're always in contact with your flight dispatcher. You can talk to maintenance personnel, meteorology, whatever you need.
My guest this morning is Patrick Smith. He's an airline pilot and a freelance writer. We're talking about his experiences as a pilot in the air industry today. We have a caller we'll take in just a moment, and we'll have more conversation after a short break. This is Focus.
Thanks to the 946 listeners who called in pledges of support during our recently ended spring membership campaign. Your participation made it a big success. You raised more than $125,000 to support your local public radio station, WILL. If you missed our pledge week, you can still help reach the April campaign goal with an online contribution at willpledge.org. And thanks for your support.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store. Strawberry Fields offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
This is Focus. I'm David Inge. We are here weekday mornings 10 until noon with 10 different topics every week. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll talk about the mortgage crisis and specifically what that has meant for the state of Illinois. Our guest will be Cedric Herring. He's professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Chicago. And then on the program Thursday morning in the 10 o'clock hour, guest is Julian Haworth. He's professor of European politics at Yale. We'll be talking about the European Union and about security issues in the world today. You can see the schedule for the complete week and listen to past programs by going to our website, that is WILL.illinois.edu. Also, a reminder that there is a flood warning in effect for Edgar County here in Illinois. That will be in effect for about another hour until 11:30 this morning. The guest in this hour, Focus, Patrick Smith. He's an airline pilot, air travel columnist for Solon.com. He is host of AskThePilot.com, a place that you can get questions answered. And also, you might take a look at a book that he's authored. The title is Ask the Pilot, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel. And it's published by Penguin and contains a lot of very basic questions and answers about planes and about flying, about what it's like to be a pilot. And you might want to take a look at that. And questions here, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can send us an email as well, and we have a couple. And that's the address is will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. Back to the phones here to Champaign. Line one, hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I know that some of the pilots have smaller airplanes that they probably maybe in conjunction with some other pilots or other people. Are you one of those or not?
No, you know, I haven't been up in a general aviation plane in probably 20 years.
The other one is that you were talking about the, in terms of the design of the aircraft, I don't know if you've seen the picture or the one that Honda's developed, airplane, one of the smaller crafts. Probably not either.
I believe that's one of those VLJs, the little jets, executive jets. Yeah, there are a whole bunch of those on the market now, although the idea of the VLJ didn't quite take off, pun intended, the way people expected it to. You know, there was this idea that all these business people were going to go out and you know buy these million-dollar planes and would be zipping around from little airport to little airport instead of relying on the big carriers, and that didn't really come to pass.
And then finally, what about in terms of are you with United or not? You mentioned United, but is that the case or not?
I really can't say who I work for.
Oh, that's all right. What about this idea there was, that at one time, you know, the airlines did their own repairs and all that kind of stuff. Now it's, I think it's outsourced or contract. Do you see any particular problem with that? There was a big thing on PBS on that.
Yeah, that comes up quite a bit. You know, there are certain things that need to be looked at, but again, I wouldn't say that there's any real crisis here.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these foreign companies that do the outsource maintenance are actually very good. Companies in Hong Kong, even the TACA facility in El Salvador, people here in El Salvador, they go, oh, my God, my plane's being repaired in El Salvador. Actually, they have a really well-respected state-of-the-art facility down there that maintains Airbuses for different carriers. So, you know, a lot of that is hype.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank
you. Welcome.
Over to Indiana for another caller here. Line four, hello.
Hello. I wonder if you could say something general about this. I have two buddies. We graduated together in high school and went on to college and stuff, and they went to the Air Force. And when they come out of the Air Force, they immediately went into commercial airline flying. I was just wondering if this is just a quick stepstone kind of thing or whether or not there's more to it than they will admit. I've asked them, I mean, you know, how was it? I mean, did you take a lot of tests? Or anything? Wouldn't say too much. But they both finished out their careers flying for commercial airlines after their experience with the Air Force. And I was wondering if the same kind of flying in the Air Force means all you do is change, you know, clothes and you're ready to go with a 707 or 747 or whatever. You can say something.
Well, commercial airline flying is very different from military flying. But it is true that a lot of pilots make the step directly from military to a commercial carrier. Now, what kind of commercial carrier? That depends on the hiring trends. Right now, for example, the major carriers aren't hiring at all. So if you were coming from the military into the airlines, you'd probably go to one of the regionals for a while until the majors began hiring again. I went up through the ranks through the civilian channels, which takes a lot longer. And tends to be more difficult, more challenging, because it's not as predictable. And, of course, you have to pay for your training yourself. Nowadays, about 50% of big airline new hires are civilian-trained, 50% are military-trained. It used to be a lot. The percentage of military flyers used to be a lot higher. It used to be somewhere 80-90%, but that's not so true anymore. And at the regional carriers, relatively few new hires are from the military. It's probably around 15 or 20%.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, very good. Well, let me go and ask you a couple of questions here based on emails. We have somebody who wrote in and tells a story. He says, I once flew a red-eye from San Francisco to New York. And once we were up, and the lights were dimmed so that people could rest, and parenthetically says, if you can actually do that on the plane. Somebody got up and started going through the upper bins because they, quote, forgot something. And the person writing in says, I wanted to get up and escort the guy back to his seat since the attendants didn't seem to want to do anything. Instead, they gave him a flashlight. And the writer says, he must have been at it for 10 minutes going through bin after bin, and people started muttering. Says, I know it sounds like I'm being cynical, but why do attendants allow such behavior, things that are disruptive and irritating and on, since passengers can be so insolent in their behavior, do attendants now feel that they can't do anything unless it's really severe?
No, I don't think that's true at all. And I think these situations will vary flight to flight, crew to crew. And if you see something like that, if you are really bothered by something, take it up with a crew member first before confronting a passenger over something that's going on, and try to resolve it that way. Almost all the time, the cabin crew will be receptive and will address the issue. I can't speak for what happened in this particular example. It does sound annoying, but not that annoying.
Well, do you know, from time to time, we do hear about problems of disruptive passengers, and sometimes that's attributed to the stress and the discomfort of flying. Do you, and I'm sure that you talk with your cabin crew all the time about what happened that day and what's going on in the plane, and in the course of flight, I'm sure if there's some sort of problem, you would be advised of that. Do you think that somehow people are any less well-behaved now than they were? You've been flying now for, like, getting on to 30 years when you started?
Well, yeah, I do think that there's been a change, a culture change. How to say this? These incidents maybe aren't terribly surprising in a system when you've got 2 million people flying in America every day. Hmm. These things are bound to happen. Especially with, the certain demographic changes among passengers we've seen. Not everybody is, upper middle class and sitting there in a tie. Maybe to some extent, when you consider how many people fly and all of the hassles and stresses of flying, that we should actually expect to see more of these sorts of incidents. So the fact that we don't is a testament to people behaving themselves.
Mm. Well, just one other thing I would like to add, because the person who wrote in also said that they just wanted to add their own fascination with planes and flying, and the person writes, it's still a wonder to me. I can't sit still and read when I'm up so high and looking at something I can never do any other way. He says that despite my age, it's still the business of planes and flying, and he says it's still fascinating. It makes him feel like a kid,
Flying cross-country used to take, 6 weeks in a stagecoach, and, now you can do it in 5 hours for $199. David, to back up for a second, mm-hmm. something I wanted to touch back on.
Sure.
When we were talking earlier about cockpit automation and the mythology of planes flying themselves. I think where that comes from is the media's tendency to focus on the aerospace academics when they need expertise on a story. You'll hear interviews with professors and researchers and consultants. These people, their work tends to be important, but they often have very little familiarity with the day-to-day, operational aspects of flying planes. And, they're usually the first people to brag about how, planes can take off and land by themselves and pilots don't really do anything, but and also, sometimes pilots are their own worst enemies, and, in their attempts to kind of simplify complicated procedures for the layperson, they'll just say something like, well, this plane just flies itself. And they don't realize that people take that literally and extrapolate it to mean, what are you doing up there then? Really, a flight is a very, organic thing, and, there are thousands of inputs and subjective decisions that go into every flight, no matter how "quote unquote" automated. I'd love to take somebody along in a simulator and show them just how complex the simplest automatic flight really is.
Yeah, About 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus. Patrick Smith is the guest. He's an airline pilot, air travel columnist for Salon.com, and host of AskThePilot.com. And it's an opportunity to ask questions about flying and get the perspective of a pilot. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We also had an email from someone who has read some of the things that you have written about some of the ideas that you had about getting the people on the plane. Just the loading of the plane can be a real problem. And again, that's a case where either people can be cooperative or not. And you had some interesting ideas about what could be done to make that go a little bit smoother. Maybe you can talk about that, but also about the idea that, you know, I'm sure that the crews have lots of ideas about how things could be made more smooth, but does anybody pay attention to the crew when they say, you know, why don't we try doing it this way?
Well, I think airlines could better enforce the boarding protocols. You know, don't let people crowd around the mouth of the jetway. Make sure people really are boarding when their row or their zone is called, that sort of thing. I think maybe airplanes should be boarded from the outside in rather than back to front. And then passengers, too, need to be responsible as far as not hogging the overhead bins, getting out of the aisle quickly. I mean, so much of this is just basic common sense and courtesy.
What about, though, the idea that that I'm sure that people who, like pilots and cabin crew, they go through this every day. They see what happens, and I'm sure that they see things that don't move smoothly, and I'm sure they say, you know, it would, rather than doing it the way we're doing it here, like, for example, the idea that you board the plane in a certain, according to where it is you're sitting in a certain way, do cabin crews feel free to say, well, wait a minute, This doesn't make any sense. Let's try something different. And then are their suggestions listened to?
Sure. I mean, airlines have channels where you can make suggestions and you know, give the higher-ups your input, and they do listen. But it's not as if, you know, nobody's thought about this before. You know, I think ultimately, you know, getting 200 people and all of their stuff onto and off of a plane is never really going to be easy. It's always going to be a bit of a jostle. Especially now where you have people carrying so much junk onto a plane.
Is that a problem? And should now, do you think, should airlines before now have been cutting back on the amount of, on what people can carry on?
I think it's a lost cause at this point. I think we're stuck with it the way it is. Now, I remember, you know, back in the day, I'm just old enough to remember airplanes when they didn't even have overhead bins, but just had the kind of open racks up top, like in a bus. And people had maybe, a briefcase or a small handbag, and that was about it, you know, long before the invention of the rollerboard and all the stuff we see now. And, oh, I mean, families with kids and three baby carriages and all of the stuff that that goes along with that. It's a little bit out of control, but I'm really not sure what we can do about it.
All right. To another caller, Savoy, line one. Hello. We can barely hear you. It would help if you could speak up a little
better?
Bit. That's
better?
Yes, that's good. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I wanted to ask a little question. Do any of you folks in the industry refer to this new thing as the Flying Titanic?
Which thing is that?
Oh, that new Airbus.
No. I guess I kind of see where you're going with that. You know, the idea of an accident. You know, killing 500 people or whatever. You know,
And then a couple thousand down below when they hit the city.
Well, no, not necessarily. You know, the Airbus 380, A380 is what he's talking about. You know, it's only a little bit bigger than a 747. When the 747 debuted back in the late 60s, early 70s, it was more than double the size of any existing plane. That was pretty radical. A real revolution in air travel. This plane, and not only is it hideous, but it's really not that much bigger than what we've already got out there. And actually, a lot of carriers, the way they've got these planes configured, they actually carry fewer people than a lot of 747s because there's so many first and business class seats on board.
I see. Well, then I have two quick follow-ups. One is, why the big fuss? But the bigger question then, I mean, like big fuss meaning why even bother and make it? Do just keep using 747s. Then the other question is, why does it require reconstruction at airports to fit the ingress and egress from the plane?
Well, mostly because it has two decks, and the second deck, the upper deck, is a full deck. It's not an annex the way the upper deck on a 747 is. And the plane also has a very long, very wide wingspan. I think it's about 50 or 60 feet wider than a 747. So although it's not bigger in terms of length, or too much bigger in terms of length, width, height, it is wider. And the problem is one of apron access, space around the gates, in and around congested terminal areas. It's not a runway issue. The plane doesn't require any more runway than any other wide-body plane. Weights it can take off in less room than a 747, but there is a problem when it's taxiing around congested areas, and that's where airports have had to readjust.
Are these things going to get to come into Reagan National?
No.
Good. Thank you.
All right, we'll go to another caller. This is Champagne, line two. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if our guest does see the column written by Captain Les Abend in Flying Magazine called Jump Seat.
Yes, I've seen it.
Okay. It really gives an interesting insight into the business of flying for the airlines, which is very interesting for me as a private pilot working in general aviation. There is a lot more involved in terms of human contact and management than possibly one can imagine. That's very interesting. I'm sure if you read it more often, you will agree with his viewpoints. I also would like to recommend, especially answering the lady who called about 15, 20 minutes ago, was surprised by these machines flying, actually getting off the ground, that if they get a chance, visit Boeing aircraft. I had a tour of it last month, and if you think it's surprising how these machines fly, you got to see how they built. It's really fascinating. And the last comment I have, the gentleman who called about the Honda jet, that is not a VLJ. This is actually close to a cabin class twin. But what's unique about it is the engines are put on top of the wing, which gives it kind of distinctive look as far as the design is concerned. Thank you.
All right. We're coming down. We just have a couple of minutes left. One thing I do want to have you talk about, because I know that it's one of the things that you've written about recently, is security, in the sense of talking about what it is that people, how people are screened and what they can bring on the plane. And certainly there's been heightened attention to this issue since 9/11. First with anything that could be possibly considered to be used as a weapon, any sharp object. And then after that, because of the thing of the people trying to blow up the plane with liquid explosives, and then you couldn't bring your coffee. There was restrictions about bringing liquids on the plane.
Yeah, it's too bad we don't have the next hour and a half to talk about this, because it's such a gigantic topic and there's so much fodder here. TSA's big fundamental flaw is really a simple one, which is that they treat every single person who flies, you know, whether it's an infant child or a uniformed crew member, as a potential terrorist. And I'm sorry, but in a system where you've got millions of people flying every day, that's just not sustainable. And the agency's own rules ultimately just aren't enforceable. The other big mistake is this obsession we still have with the September 11th scheme, you know, the idea of the in-flight takeover and the suicide, flying into buildings. I mean, from a terrorist point of view, that MO is really off the table for a whole host of reasons. It's very unlikely to succeed, and so no terrorist is going to put resources into something with such a high likelihood of failure. Yet, we're fighting the last war, looking for box cutters, looking for pointy things. Does any of that really matter? No. 9/11. The success of those attacks really wasn't about weapons at all. If box cutters had been banned at the time, they would have just used something else. That wasn't the point. The success of the attacks relied not on weapons, but on the element of surprise and taking advantage of our mindset at the time and what our expectations of a hijacking were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back in those days, we had, you know, it was called passive resistance, where, you know, basically you let people hijack the plane. And that's not true anymore. And for that reason, you know, that kind of thing just wouldn't succeed. And is it really worth our time and effort to go ransacking people's bags for little penknives, you know, which are effectively harmless items? You know, these are resources, security resources, that could be better spent, you know, looking for bombs, looking for explosives, and, you know, doing things behind the scenes to keep terrorists away from planes. And really, that's what airport security is all about. It's stopping people before they get to the airport itself.
Mm. And though, given that these rules that we're living with now, you expect that we're going to be living with them now from now on?
It really seems that way, which is terribly depressing. You know, maybe at some point there will be a shakeup and the agency will reevaluate its protocols and we'll see some changes. But, you know, it's already been 10 years, and you know, these policies have become so entrenched and you know, so much of it is just foolish. But they don't seem to be going away. The Europeans, to their credit, are, you know, talking about a phase out of the silly liquids and gels restrictions, but here in the States, you know, we still can't bring box cutters on, you still can't bring your toothpaste on, you still got to take your shoes off, and, you know, all of these things that are mostly for show and don't really enhance actual security.
Well, we're going to have to stop at this point. For people who are interested in reading more about the pilot's life and about air travel issues, you can look for the column in Salon that our guest writes. He's air traffic columnist for Salon.com. Also has the website AskThePilot.com, and some of that you can find in his book, Ask the Pilot, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel. Patrick Smith is his name. And Mr. Smith, thanks very much for talking with us today.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you.